Welcome back to Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. Well, we're podcasting our show, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. And if you have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line at yourcall@klw.org or call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or leave your comments on our website at yourcallradio.org. So now let's talk about hospice care. Half of all Americans now die in hospice. At the start of this century, for-profit providers made up 30% of the field, but today they represent more than 70%. And between 2011 and 2019 alone, research shows that the number of hospices owned by private equity firms tripled. Ava Kaufman's new ProPublica investigation focuses on this growing and very profitable hospice industry that seems rife with fraud and exploitation. So for this investigation, Ava drew on medical records, state and federal licenses, inspection and complaint surveys, government watchdog reports, thousands of pages of court documents and interviews with more than 100 families, hospice employees, elder care experts, attorneys, and government officials. So we're so pleased to be joined by Ava Kaufman, reporter on ProPublica's national desk, where she has reported on frontline healthcare workers, the unemployment system, content moderation, college admissions, among many other subjects, and is now joining us to discuss what is happening in the for-profit hospice industry. Ava, thanks so much for joining Your Call.
Thanks for having me.
So, Ava, before we dive in and talk about your investigation and what you found, can you just tell us a bit about what drew you to the story in the first place?
Yeah, I'd covered some of the issues that were going on with assisted living facilities during the pandemic, and talking to some of those seniors about just how unheard they felt during the whole crisis. You know, there was a lot of coverage, of course, of long-term care, but we rarely heard from the people who were actually inside these facilities in that coverage. Got me a lot more interested in covering elder care issues in general. And when I'd heard a bit about what was happening in California, the Los Angeles Times had done a great investigation in December 2020, looking at the rampant explosion of hospices in our state here. I became curious about whether or not the same thing was going on across the country. And so that's kind of what got me started investigating hospice.
Well, it's always interesting to hear how one story kind of leads to another. But in terms of the hospice industry, can you just give us a sense as to how big this industry is?
Sure. So hospice, I mean, starts out in the late 1960s as essentially a charity movement. So unlike other sectors of, you know, healthcare was kind of, you know, a fringe volunteer, you know, countercultural movement. I mean, these, you know, nurses and nuns and people who believed in kind of spreading death with dignity, you know, were almost kind of, you know, death doulas and never really saw this being a kind of money-making enterprise. And, you know, fast forward to today, hospice is a $22 billion industry. With, as you noted, you know, 70% of hospices being for profit. And each year, you know, millions of Americans and, you know, their families, like, you know, are also kind of part of the hospice experience, are using hospice. So it's grown, I think, you know, far beyond what its initial kind of, you know, founders and, you know, followers in the movement ever envisioned.
Mm-hmm. Well, your article really paints a pretty troubling picture of what's happening there. It seems like, you know, as you say, the initial impulse was a very good one. And it seems like perhaps we're dealing with some lax regulation here. And I want to talk about Marsha Farmer, salesperson that you profiled in your story, because to qualify for hospice, patients have to agree to forego curative care and be certified by doctors as having less than 6 months to live. And so people like Marsha were soliciting recruits regardless of whether they were near death. And you write how she canvassed birthday parties at housing projects and went door to door promoting the program to people who seemed elderly and potentially could qualify. And she said to you that we'd find rundown places where people were more on the poverty line looking for uneducated people, if you will, because you're able to provide something to them and meet a need. It feels very predatory. And so my question for you is, how common is this practice that people like Marsha are engaging in to recruit, or were engaging in to recruit patients?
Yeah, Marcia is one of just, you know, a dozen of marketers I talk to across the country who are all using fairly similar tactics to kind of, you know, find people who might benefit for the hospice service. And I think one thing that's kind of, you know, troubling about hospice marketing is, you know, typically you would think to enter hospice and, you know, of course, this is what, you know, a lot of upstanding programs and providers do. You would receive a referral from a doctor. And, you know, that doctor would, you know, tell you or have a conversation with your family that, you know, maybe it's time to make that choice. And instead, what we've seen, and this has been happening since at least 1995, there are government watchdog reports, you know, going back almost a quarter of a century documenting this, is people are marketing hospice directly to families who might not know what it is. Who might be told it's another version of free home health care, who might just need an extra pair of hands, you know, in which case it can, and in some cases, be a kind of win-win to have an extra pair of eyes coming by, given, you know, the paucity of elder care services in this country. And in other cases, I mean, people are signing these forms and kind of being tricked, but hospice is being sold door to door as though it's just, you know, a used car, or a Bible, or, you know, an ice cream. And that's, you know, obviously, when we think of healthcare services, that's probably, you know, not how we want to be making those decisions or receiving them.
Yeah, well, but to qualify for federal healthcare reimbursement, you have to show that you've got, if you're a hospice company, that you've got a certain, you know, average number of people who are below that sort of 6 month threshold before they pass away. But then, given that the regulation is in place, what are the companies doing to sort of evade this and being able to sign up people who really probably should not qualify for hospice care?
Yeah. So yeah, to qualify for hospice, as you mentioned, you know, you have to be certified by two doctors as having a terminal illness that, if it was expected to run its normal course, you know, would mean that you'd likely have less than 6 months to live. Of course, it's not an exact science. And it's totally normal and expected that some people are going to have, you know, far less than 6 months, and other people are going to have, you know, far more. It's, you know, a moving and somewhat arbitrary goalpost. But, you know, companies are getting around this by essentially, and I should say just some companies, but they are, you know, cherry picking patients who have much longer than 6 months to live, and picking patients who are stable and require fewer medications. And of course, these kinds of patient selection practices, you know, are happening, you know, in all kinds of different sectors of healthcare. But in hospice in particular, it's something that, you know, even Medicare's own federal advisory panel, MedPAC, has been pointing out, has been going on, you know, for years. You know, one of the things I was interested in exploring was the effect that was having both on the, you know, the margins of these hospice providers who are, you know, all but in some cases recruiting people, you know, actively recruiting people who are not dying, and also the effect it's having on patients and their families.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're just joining us, this is Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We're discussing the for-profit hospice care industry, joined by Ava Kaufman, reporter on ProPublica's national desk, where she authored a really informative and pretty alarming investigative deep dive into this industry. But we want to hear from you. Have you been recruited by hospice care marketers? Do you know or have a family member who has been? Are you concerned about this for-profit model? You could call to join the conversation at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. So, Ava, let me ask you about how these regulations are being enforced, because it seems like the crux of it here is what you just said, which is that, you know, you've got to show that basically the average is that people are going to pass away within 6 months, but that's impossible to ever really fully predict. And it seems like the companies are sort of hiding behind that wiggle room. And is that your impression as well? And if so, what should be done about it to try to clamp down on this abuse by these for-profit companies?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, prognostication is a, you know, very inexact science, but CMS, you know, has data already. And, you know, it's data that, you know, certain researchers have been able to also download and work with, that shows that, you know, particular hospices are discharging, and that means, you know, taking off their roles up to 90% or over 90% of their patients alive. So, you know, it's one thing if, you know, not all of your patients are, you know, quote unquote, use a horrible expression, dying on time, but there are hospice providers out there where none of their patients, you know, are ever dying. And, you know, that's such a kind of blatant and egregious and eyebrow raising type of fraud that, you know, it raises, I think, serious questions about what Medicare, you know, what the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services are doing with their own data, and why there isn't more oversight. And one of the things that's been found in California in particular is, you know, this just kind of rapid increase in the number of hospice agencies that far outstrips the need. And so when, you know, when you get this flood of hospice licenses, of course, you're not going to be able to find enough dying patients because there's, you know, this is a finite, this is a finite population.
Well, and I also, you know, I think you would agree this is a, definitely a vital and caring service, right, to make sure that people die with dignity. And, you know, many people you spoke with praise that mission of hospice care, but they did have concerns about the easy money involved and this lack of regulation that we've been describing. And I'm curious if you could just describe a little bit for listeners just about how lucrative this can be. Because it looks like, as you wrote, a small hospice that bills for just 20 patients at the basic rate can take in more than $1 million a year. And obviously, if you have more patients, which many of these for-profit hospice companies do, that's hundreds of millions of dollars a year. So what, can you describe a bit about the economics here?
Sure, yeah. And just to jump off your point, I mean, hospice is an amazing service, and when done right, and when you're actually kind of providing all of the services that families need, you know, it can cost a lot of money. And I think there are a lot of providers who are saying, you know, this isn't actually as lucrative as it may seem. You know, the problem I found, or the loophole I found in my own reporting, is that, you know, it's also really easy to cut corners. So, you know, the system's built right now on these kind of good faith assumptions that, you know, a hospice is going to be billing for services that it's providing. But there are lots of hospices that, you know, aren't really providing those services, in which case they're getting this, you know, the way the payment works, just to dig into it a little more, is you're getting this daily flat rate payment. And, you know, you can stretch it to kind of go a long way, or it might not go a long way if you're really, you know, having nurses come by all the time and using bereavement counselors and all of the, you know, amazing and essential services and, you know, holistic services that, you know, hospice provides that are, you know, often quite missing from the rest of our healthcare system. But, you know, if you're cutting corners on care, and you don't have to set up your own inpatient facility, which, you know, actually the majority of hospices don't have, you know, there's very little need to have a kind of brick and mortar location. You know, most of the care is taking place in people's homes. Most of the care is provided by families, you know, even in the best of circumstances. A hospice, you know, isn't there around the clock. It's usually your loved one who's providing a lot of that care. And so what MedPAC, this federal advisory commission, has found is, you know, the margins are, you know, 20% for for-profit providers and closer to 3% for nonprofit providers. And so I think that tells you a bit about, you know, some of the services being offered and how much money there can be made.
Yeah, huge disparity there in terms of profit margins. It also seems like there's very low barriers to entry to start a hospice program. And you describe how a medical background is not required to enter the business, that you've come across hospices owned by accountants, vacation rental superhosts, a criminal defense attorney who represented a hospice employee convicted of fraud and was later investigated for hospice fraud himself, a man convicted of drug distribution and went on to fraudulently bill Medicare more than $5 million for an end-of-life care business that involved handling large quantities of narcotics. So it kind of feels like the Wild West in terms of who's allowed to start one of these for-profit businesses. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, what I found is it did feel like, you know, there's no medical background required to start a hospice. A lot of people are getting into hospice from fields that, you know, you might wonder kind of, you know, how it fits on their resume, given the lack of previous healthcare experience. And, you know, what's been found recently in California in particular, there was a state audit report earlier this year, is that, you know, because there's so little oversight at the California Department of Public Health in particular, people are even just using stolen, you know, the stolen identities of medical professionals who have nothing to do with that actual hospice. And even when those medical professionals are, you know, filing complaints or letting people know, you know, this, I have to, I'm not related to this hospice. There's been a little crackdown and a little oversight to get to the bottom of it. So absolutely the Wild Wild West.
Well, and Ava, what are the harms here for society? I mean, obviously, it seems like there's, you know, a fair amount of fraud going on with our Medicare dollars, taxpayer dollars. But what about for the people who are caught up in these for-profit hospice care systems that probably don't otherwise need them? What's the risk here? What's the harm to these individuals?
Yeah, so one of the things that people don't realize is that when you're signing up for hospice, you are trading your right to access curative care. And you're transitioning to comfort and palliative care. And often that's can be a really good thing if you need hospice and is, you know, something that a lot of families say they'd wish they'd done even sooner. And, you know, sometimes people are, you know, afraid of making that choice, but it's really important. But if you're someone who doesn't actually need hospice and who's surreptitiously, you know, signed away your rights to life-saving treatments, you might be denied access to a mammogram when you go to the doctor. You might need a cataract surgery and not be able to get that because you didn't realize that you were on hospice and not home health care. There's been stories of people losing access and losing, you know, their place on a waiting list for a liver transplant. A lot of people feel like they lose their faith as well in the, you know, medical system when, you know, they think that they've been signed up for one thing and end up getting another. And so, you know, the fraud is definitely not a victimless crime and can pose serious risk to Medicare beneficiaries who are duped under the service.
Yeah, well, so when these for-profit marketers come and describe the service here, are they really adequately disclosing those risks, what people are giving up by signing up, what you just described? And or are they targeting particularly vulnerable parts of our population, perhaps low-income people, people of color? Is this sort of a predatory thing that's happening here? And could more be done to crack down on that disclosure?
I think definitely more can be done in terms of, you know, asking, you know, all hospices and making it clear that, you know, you need to disclose exactly what kind of, you know, service you're getting when you're signing up for hospice. You know, one of the main things I've been hearing from the Senior Medicare Patrol, which deals with complaints for people who are, you know, victims of Medicare fraud, among other issues, is, you know, they've been seeing an uptick in complaints of people who had no idea they were getting signed up for hospice and thought they were receiving something else. And these kinds of people might be targeted outside of hospitals. They've just gotten out of the hospital. They might be outside of a 99 cent shop or a donut shop. They might be in an assisted living community and, you know, appreciate the extra company of having someone come by or an aide come by once a week. But having, you know, no idea and never being told that they were about to die. And so, yes, I think, you know, some hospices are, you know, completely disclosing that even when they're marketing door to door. But what we've seen time and again, you know, from various government agencies and from, you know, I think over 100 plus now False Claims Act lawsuits is that a lot of marketers are saying, you know, we are kind of, you know, deliberately not telling people the bill of goods that they're signing up for.
Well, let's talk about some of the enforcement and efforts at cracking down on this. There have been some lawsuits, including by the federal government. You profile, as I mentioned, Marsha Farmer, who was a marketer, but also Don Richardson, a nurse, both of whom decided to blow the whistle on AseraCare. They filed a whistleblower complaint against that company in Golden Living in the Northern District of Alabama, accusing the company of Medicare fraud. Can you describe this pretty unbelievable saga of what happened with that lawsuit and what the current status is now of a potential federal enforcement?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, the False Claims Act allows employees at, you know, or any private citizen really to file a complaint against a government contractor for defrauding the government. And so, you know, often you'll have current or former healthcare employees who notice that something isn't right at their workplace and courageously, like Marsha and Don, decide to, you know, not just see something, but say something about it to the Department of Justice. And so, you know, when Marsha kind of realized that what was going on in her workplace wasn't just making her uncomfortable or wasn't just uneasy, but, you know, might also be unethical, she and Don filed a secret complaint under the False Claims Act that went on to go to trial, which is, you know, really unusual and was part of what drew me to the case. There's so few False Claims Act cases that actually end up going to trial. And it kind of became this litmus test for, you know, whether or not this law, this, you know, Civil War era law meant to kind of, you know, protect the government from fraudulent contracting in, you know, the defense industry, you know, works and can be and can hold, you know, healthcare entities like hospice providers submitting potentially false claims around reimbursement for, you know, potentially ineligible hospice patients accountable. And I can go into more of the details, but I'll stop there for now.
Well, yeah, that's a pretty amazing saga with the court case. It sounds like some pretty interesting shenanigans with a potentially conflicted judge and a federal Department of Justice attorney who eventually became a crook as a result of this case. You want to at least describe some of what happened there?
So what ends up happening in the case is, you know, it actually ends up becoming a kind of, I think, you know, really interesting, and I think still on the table, you know, philosophical question about, you know, what actually counts as a false claim. You know, if a doctor is signing up patients for hospice, at the time, you know, that doctor, you know, has every reason to say, you know, I would have no way of knowing that, you know, 6 months from now, this person is or isn't going to die. And so it is actually quite, you know, tricky, to hold hospice providers, you know, accountable for, you know, false claims just in and of themselves being false. If you don't have kind of wider evidence that this, you know, a hospice might have been committing, you know, schemes or, you know, knowingly submitting these claims, and having an understanding that they were fraudulent. You know, a doctor's signature maybe on its own isn't enough to, you know, prove a claim is false. But what ends up happening in this trial is that, you know, all that the government is allowed to present in the first phase of the trial is just the, you know, is just the medical record that supports the false claim. And they weren't allowed to kind of bring in all of the marketing practices and, you know, everything else that the whistleblowers had kind of described that created these conditions of, you know, pressuring people to admit patients, they alleged, and so forth. And so that's kind of why it becomes such a landmark case.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like there will be some ongoing litigation potentially to follow, but I definitely recommend the listeners to check out your account of the lawsuit that happened. I do want to mention that the National Association for Home Care and Hospice and the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization did issue a press release in response to your article. And they said, unfortunately, articles of this type may unwittingly discourage use of hospice care, thereby denying terminally ill patients and their families access to vital services that support and comfort them during and in the aftermath of one of life's most difficult journeys. What's your response to that criticism from the industry association?
Yeah, I think that's always the fear, you know, about any sort of journalistic investigation is that in showing the kind of warts or underbelly, you might be leading people to throw out the baby with the bathwater. I mean, my understanding from hearing back from readers and hearing back as well from people in the government who work on these issues and are dealing with kind of, you know, consumers and clients navigating this all the time is that, you know, understanding that these problems exist, that they're systemic, that they're rooted not just in, you know, the particular decisions of actors or a particular story of a particular family, but in, you know, deeply systemic ways in which this entire kind of benefit system is designed, hopefully will allow families to do more research and reading and figure out the best hospice provider for their family, because it's obviously such an essential service.
Well, I appreciate you shining a light on this industry. And the last question for you is, are there any plans in Congress or by regulators to look more closely at this industry and come up with some solutions here for these kinds of abuses?
That's a great question. I'm hoping to hear the answer to it as well.
And I guess as another follow-up for listeners who are concerned about this, what do you recommend people do to sort of be on guard?
We're going to put out a guide to help people both spot and identify signs of fraud. I mean, the first thing is that if someone's offering you something that sounds, you know, too good to be true, definitely take a look at it and always try to talk to your doctor before, you know, switching or signing up for a different, you know, form of your Medicare benefit. And then the second thing is just, you know, doing your homework. I think there's a lot of people who think of hospice as just kind of a monolith, and it is, you know, hospice with a capital H. And it turns out, you know, there's 5,000 different hospice providers in this country. And, you know, so many of them are trying to do the right thing. And with a little research, you know, encouraging families to steer themselves, you know, towards those providers is going to make, you know, both those providers and the entire industry, I think, a lot stronger.
Well, Ava Kaufman, reporter on ProPublica's national desk, thank you so much for your work and for coming on Your Call. We greatly appreciate it.
Thank you.
And we'll make sure to have a link to your article on our webpage at yourcallradio.org. And to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, you can visit that same webpage. And also find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review. You can follow us on Twitter at Your Call Radio and email us show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Well, Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this was Your Call's Media Roundtable.